You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we learn how the ubiquitous grocery store banana tells the story of what happens when we have dangerously small amounts of plant diversity.
Right now, fairy tales are a huge part of culture, from the old Grimm Brothers tales to the more modern versions, like the parallels between the Hunger Games trilogy and Jack and the Beanstalk.
Researchers now know just how old some of those fairy tales are. Gemma Tarlek joins us now to share the details of this and other cool science news. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, and she joins us once or twice a month to share science news. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Greetings, my fellow fans of science.
Hello. So, these fairy tales, this story really grabbed me. So how are researchers looking at the age of fairy tales? It's not like a fossil that you put it in some machine and it says, oh, this many million years old. So how do you look at the age of fairy tales?
Well, actually, it's funny you should say it's not like a fossil because you're right. However, the same kind of techniques that paleontologists are using increasingly to study different fossils and different extinct animals, something called phylogenetics, these same techniques were applied to fairy tales. And basically, instead of just like picking up the fossil and looking at it and figuring out what layer of rock it came from and how old those rocks are, phylogenetic research for fossils kind of tracks the relationships between different organisms and figures out when they evolved, when they diverged from each other in the case of closely related species. And it's a lot of data crunching, but the great thing is those methods have now been applied to actual fairy tales, and specifically a fairy tale called The Smith and the Devil. And you guys, if you've been around for any amount of time, you have heard some variation of this story, but it's basically a blacksmith sells his soul to the devil and then in the end, like, uses his magic powers that he got to kind of, you know, come out on top, and the poor devil doesn't get the bargain that he wanted. So, I mean, if you think about The Devil Went Down to Georgia and the famous tale of Crossroads and all those tales, they're all kind of permutations of The Smith and the Devil. And they figured out using phylogenetics that this goes back more than 7,000 years.
That's a long time.
Yeah, and it's all about, they look at linguistics and how the linguistic elements of the stories evolved. And using linguistics the same way a paleontologist would use traits, say, in a fossil, like the length of the skull or the width of the eye socket, etc., they can use that to phylogenetically trace it back in time. So, yeah, we're talking 7,000 years of, you know, Smiths and whatnot selling the devil their souls and the devil not catching on. So I don't know about that.
Gemma, is it surprising to you that we can use linguistics in this very scientific way?
Oh, not at all. You know, increasingly, what's really exciting, I think, in the world of science is that a lot of fields, whether they be linguistics or, again, paleontology, a lot of fields are more and more able to use data in a very kind of hard scientific way that, say, physicists did before. Whereas a lot of the cases in the past, these fields had to rely on, well, what can I see? What can I hear? Now they're able to really input a lot of data into sophisticated programs and use very sophisticated, refined methods of calculation to learn a lot more about the information than they would have had even 10 or 20 years ago.
Well, there's another area that we're looking at this month that kind of fits into that of using the same kind of science on a very different type of subject. And, you know, we've heard a lot about the intelligence of animals and finding out things like, we were just talking the other day, that octopus is way more intelligent than people realize. They're now looking at the brain power of plants, and apparently they're pretty smart. What are we finding out about how plants think?
Yeah, well, it's incredible stuff. And I have to say that a lot of botanists and people who study plant behavior, a lot of them would say, hey, now, don't talk about plants having brains. So we're not going to go quite that far. But just in terms of plant behavior, that term, plant behavior itself, that was really not used 20 or 30 years ago because we just had no idea. But yeah, there's this new research out. A lot of different areas of research are kind of coming together to let us know that plants are capable of a lot more than we thought. They can form memories and act on those memories. They can communicate with each other. And they can even be trained the same way Pavlov trained his hungry dogs. Mm. If you remember that experiment, you know, the dogs learned that a ring of the bell meant that they were going to get food.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, this researcher in Australia taught garden peas to go through a maze to find light. And it's a little bit complicated, but she did it. Basically, it's associative learning, and she trained them over a period of days to associate a fan with light. And then another group was taught to associate a fan with no light. And then a control group was, you know, just kind of like, do what you want, guys. Doesn't matter. The fan doesn't have any significance. But then, you know, looking at the results of the three groups, the two groups of peas that were clearly trained to associate the lack of a fan or the presence of a fan with light actually learned. And they grew in the direction that would get them light. Which is, it's when you think about it, it's crazy. But then it gets even crazier because there are all these other experiments. For example, you know, you may be familiar with the Mimosa pudica plant, which is it's the leaves close if you even brush them. You know, they just kind of like, whoop, close right up. This one group of researchers tried dropping them from a height of about 6 inches. And don't worry, no plants were harmed in this experiment. But they dropped them, and the first couple times the leaves closed. And then the plants figured out, oh, I don't have to do this. So after a few drops, the leaves would not close at all. But then they took those same plants and they shook them. Again, no plants harmed in this experiment. And they kind of like, you know, shook them really rapidly, and the plants, the leaves close again. So it shows that the plants learned that dropping does not necessarily mean harm. It just means some crazy researcher is at it again, and that you don't have to close your leaves. So, and oh my gosh, there's so many other really fascinating experiments too about how they can communicate through this underground network of fungi that basically they can relay, hey, I'm getting eaten by aphids. You know, you got to release volatile chemicals to protect yourself. You know, save yourself. And just all these amazing ways that plants are able to do way more than we ever thought capable.
Well, Gemma, what should we make of this then? If plants have the capability of memory, if they have the capability of learning, shouldn't our crops, you know, shouldn't we have much better crops if we can communicate with them?
Well, you know, what's in it for the plants to have a better crop?
Like, you know. Getting eaten, most likely.
You know, I have to admit, I garden and I am starting seeds inside, and last night it was time to do a little bit of culling, and I really had this moment of, oh my gosh, do they know what's coming? What have they said about me behind my back? You know, the seedlings know what's going to happen now. But yeah, you know, I mean, it's just we're really at the early stages. And there are a lot of very fascinating experiments, but we're still figuring out what there is to learn. And so in terms of, you know, convincing some corn that it needs to grow taller or whatever, I think that's a long way away.
We're talking with Gemma Tarlak right now. She is senior editor at Discover Magazine, which is based in Waukesha. And Gemma, finally, our understanding of dinosaurs has changed a lot in the last century. What did scientists used to think about them?
Well, you know, I love dinosaurs, always have, but I just cringe when I look at some of the stuff in the history books. And basically, you know, the term dinosaur has been around for about 170 years. It's actually older than Darwin's theory of evolution. Hmm. And basically, these budding paleontologists in this new field started digging up weird bones from animals they didn't recognize. And all they really had at that point were the naked eye to look at the fossil and think, well, what does this look like? What animal alive today does this look like? Oh, it kind of looks like an iguana. This thing must have been a giant iguana. And, you know, for a long time, that's all paleontologists had. You know, it's kind of like we were talking about linguistics before, that it's only been in the recent decades that new techniques have been able to really refine what we can say and what we can see about a fossil. So basically, there were a lot of disastrously sprawled hips, kind of giant crocodile-like animals. no one ever thought they would be the super fleet-footed bipeds or you know, two-legged animals like you see in Jurassic Park, for example, the velociraptors. I mean, back in the 19th century, no one thought dinosaurs were like velociraptors. That's crazy talk. So we really kind of do an overview of how the opinion has changed from these big, sluggish lummoxes to the fleet-footed bipeds that we know today.
So what have been the aha moments? What's changed about dinosaur research so much that has evolved?
Well, a lot of it is adding to the fossil record. We found a lot more fossils in a lot more places. So we have a lot more data from the fossil record, which is helpful. And some of the new finds have been really extraordinary in that we're able to see relationships that we could not have seen clearly before. For example, since 1995, we've been finding more and more feathered dinosaurs. And, you know, even 20, 30 years ago, the idea that dinosaurs were descended from birds, or excuse me, that birds were descended from dinosaurs was still kind of out there. No one really accepted it until more fossil finds, such as Deinonychus and feathered fossils, especially feathered dinosaurs from China, really filled in those blanks. And it's also, it gets back to that data crunching I was talking about with linguistics as well, that the more information you have and the more sophisticated methods you have to process that information, the better your results, the more you're able to prove a theory or disprove it and go back to the drawing board.
Well, Gemma, on that note, we're going to go out with the theme from Jurassic Park in honor of all we learned about dinosaurs over the decades, the hundreds of years. Gemma, thanks so much for joining us today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Gemma Tarlak. She's senior editor at Discover Magazine that is based in Waukesha.
Coming up after the news, we find out about heroes who are trying to save diversity in agricultural seeds with the aim of saving us all. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.